You have leading anti-trans campaigners saying that any number of trans people is a major problem to society. Parents with kids that they're worried that their kid is going to emotionally crash if they lose access to treatment, this is just trying to keep their kid alive. You talk with the people who are trotted out at these hearings by Republicans trying to ban healthcare for trans youth. The parents that they drag out, you never hear about their kids. Why would you take parenting advice from somebody whose child no longer wants anything to do with them?
Welcome to episode 155 of the Refuse Fascism podcast, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in the United States. In today's episode, we're sharing an interview with Bryn Tanhill on the sweeping and intensifying attacks on trans people in this country. Thanks to everyone who goes the extra step and rates and reviews the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you appreciate the show and want to help us reach more people who want to refuse fascism, be a gem and go write a review and drop 5 stars wherever you listen to your pods. I can't overemphasize what a difference this makes. Please tell the people out there in podcast land why you listen, and they should too. Subscribe, follow, so you never miss an episode. And of course, keep up all that great commenting and sharing on social media and YouTube. Thank you to everyone on Patreon for supporting the show for $2 or more a month. Thanks, patrons. Not one yet? Become one at patreon.com/refusefascism. Before we get into it, we want to salute the Dream Defenders and others who staged a nonviolent sit-in at Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' office this past week, blocking its entrance to protest his fascist agenda. Organizers said, quote, "We're trying to avoid chasing after each attack, but instead unite the people of Florida against DeSantis and his attempts to destroy the remnants of democracy in Florida," end quote. This includes a 6-week abortion ban, attacks on LGBTQ rights, attacks on voting rights, immigrants, and education. They refused to leave the office until he would meet with them. And at 7 p.m. on Wednesday night, DeSantis still had not met with them, and 14 people were forcibly removed, arrested, and charged with trespassing. Here is a clip of some of what they sang while occupying the office. We will have an organizer on next week to talk more about this. This past week, it was significant that 4 members of the Proud Boy organization, including former leader Enrique Tarrio, were convicted of seditious conspiracy for trying to keep Donald Trump in office by force after his electoral defeat to Biden. We highly recommend checking out our interview with Andy Campbell, author of Proud Boys in a New Era of American Fascism, and of course, reading his book. When interviewed on Democracy Now! After the conviction, Andy made this really key point that, quote, "Trump has celebrated and tacitly supported these extremist elements since he took office. And until his politicians around him, until the right wing rebuffs them, we are seeing these extremist elements marching today, regardless of the fact that their fellow Proud Boys and Oath Keepers are in prison," end quote. It points to the need to have an all-out society-wide refusal of fascism and fascist movements. So listen or re-listen to our conversation with him that we had this past December. It will be linked in our show notes. Now, here is my conversation with Bryn. According to HRC, over 540 anti-LGBTQ bills have been introduced in state legislatures this year, a record. Over 220 bills specifically targeting transgender and non-binary people, also a record. And 45 anti-LGBTQ laws have been enacted so far this year. More than 125 bills in 2023 were introduced that, if they went through, would prevent trans youth from being able to access age-appropriate, medically necessary, best practice healthcare, in addition to more than 45 bills banning transgender students from playing school sports, more than 30 quote-unquote bathroom bills, a figure that exceeds the number of bathroom bills filed in any previous year. On the show, we talk a lot about this triad that fascist movements foment and rely upon: patriarchy, American chauvinism, xenophobia, and white supremacy. And we've seen this patriarchy trend really, really advance since this past summer. This is the Christian fascist movement. It infects the judiciary, state houses across the country, and is aided by a rabid armed fascist mob that threatens doctors who provide gender-affirming care, intimidates drag performers, and hounds families. They have an aim, an eliminationist aim, where even one trans person is too many. This week, as almost every week has been this year, is an advancing horror. With Oklahoma Governor Gavin Stitt signed a ban on gender-affirming care for minors, healthcare providers who are accused of violating this new law could face felony charges, and the ban went into effect immediately. In Indiana, you have Governor Eric Holcomb, who signed a bill that would prohibit local governments from stopping the absolutely dangerous, heinous, abusive practice of so-called conversion therapy. In Florida, not to be outdone, passed three, one was signed, anti-LGBTQ bans. HB 1521 criminalizes transgender people of all ages from using a restroom that matches their gender identity. This prohibits gender-inclusive restrooms and changing facilities in schools, public shelters, healthcare facilities, and jails. And the expansion of Florida's Don't Say Gay law also went forward. Most heinously, Florida legislators sent an extreme gender-affirming care ban, SB 254, to DeSantis's desk for signature. This would give Florida unprecedented ability to strip parental rights from parents who support their transgender children. It would penalize providers, including felony penalties for those who provide gender-affirming care, taking away license from those providers. It prevents Medicaid from being used in any capacity or public funds in any way, including university funds, to be used to provide benefits that include gender-affirming care for transgender people of all ages. And so sinisterly, it allows the state to use gender-affirming care or the risk of such care for a child as a reason to give Florida family court exceptional jurisdiction to set aside another state's custody determination. Those were some of the horrific things that went down this week. To get into all of this, to help people understand what the fuck is going on and how it connects to this Christian fascist movement in all its horror, I am so glad to welcome back Bryn Tanhill. Bryn is a former aviator in the U.S. Navy, the author of American Fascism, How the GOP is Subverting Democracy. She recently wrote an incredibly powerful and heart-wrenching essay for The New Republic titled The End of Trans America Comes into Focus. And recently, I saw that she was the editor of a book called My Child Told Me They're Trans, What Do I Do Now? Welcome back, Bryn. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Just came out this year in February.
Oh, this is so exciting. I was so glad to see that. There is a book that is geared towards embracing parents who want to do good by their children.
This is a funny thing about it, is the book is a series of interviews with 17 different parents of trans youth from a variety of different backgrounds, moms, dads, people from all over the country of different faiths. Their kids came out at different ages. You have people with non-binary kids, people with transmasculine, transfeminine kids, kids who came out as little kids, kids who came out when they were 16, 17. It runs the whole gamut. Some of my favorite interviews are with Master Sergeant Nathan Glickler, United States Air Force, who takes a very military approach of, we're supporting my kid. You can get on board or you can get out. Are there questions? I didn't think so. Now let's move out smartly. And then one parent is a pediatrician who's Muslim. And it also has interviews with experts, and it's arranged in kind of a Q&A format. And what's really cool about this book is these are all parents who have wonderful, loving relationships with their kids, where if their kids are old enough, you could go and interview any of the kids, and they would tell you the same thing that the parents are telling, that their stories match up. This is not a secret. Whereas when you talk with the people who are trotted out at these hearings by Republicans trying to ban healthcare for trans youth, the parents that they drag out, you never hear about their kids. You never talk to their kids. Their kids are almost never in the press. And when the press does track down their kids, these kids no longer have relationships with their parents because their parents have destroyed them. So it's kind of like, why would you take parenting advice from somebody whose child no longer wants anything to do with them? where 90% of them, their kids never want to speak to them again. I mean, if you don't want to have a relationship with your kids, you never want them to speak with you again, by all means, listen to these people and do exactly what they tell you to. But what I would say is any parent who decides, I would rather my kid were dead and gone than be gay or trans, why were you having kids in the first place? And then when you interview the kids, you look at these kids and they're brilliant, they're smart, they're funny, they're creative, they're awesome kids. I've talked to some of these kids that have very public parents out there who are fighting against trans rights. And so many of them, because they were hurt so badly right in their formative years, when they were trying to come out, when they were the most vulnerable, and they're saying, Mom, Dad, I'm trans, I'm gay, I'm something. And then they get tossed, they get rejected, they get put in conversion therapy, they get sent to conversion therapy gulags in the Utah desert. These people took absolutely wonderful, brilliant, fantastic kids, and they broke them in half. And here we have an entire swath of states deciding that they're going to listen to parents who not only destroyed their relationships with their kids, but a lot of times just broke their kids. And this is how we've decided we want to legislate parenting and medical decisions. I can't describe the level of awful, but if you want to understand parents who have wonderful relationships with their kids, maybe you should listen to the ones who still have that. And that's why I wrote this book, so that parents who don't know what to do, who want to have relationships with their kids, who don't want to break their kids, who want their kids to grow up to be healthy and happy and have loving relationships with them and have them be functional, good adults. This is for them. This is for parents who want to do what's best for their kids and not what they think is best for their relationship with a church or with some supernatural being. If there is such a thing as a kind and loving God, I don't think he would want you to take your kid and break them in half. There's a book out there literally on do-it-yourself conversion therapy on your kid. And these are the narratives that I'm trying to fight. The narratives that are out there are being pushed by organizations like the Heritage Foundation and Alliance Defending Freedom, organizations with millions and millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, unlimited cash, versus me trying to do this as a passion project because I want to do something for our kids. And I think the proof is in the pudding. My oldest is trans and he's 20 and he's attending a top flight university. He's getting mostly A's, few B's, majoring in neuropsychology, and he's a great freaking kid.
It's incredible what can happen when children are supported and given the love that helps them thrive. And I think that as an educator, I have seen both outcomes, what happens when children are supported with whatever it is and when they're not. I'm really glad that your book exists. We're going to make sure that it gets in the show notes. Folks should read it.
It's titled, My Child Told Me They're Trans. What Do I Do? A Q&A Guide for Parents.
Beautiful. I was hoping that you could help us step back a little bit. What's happening? What do people need to understand about the attacks on trans folks? I was going to say trans kids, but the truth of the matter is it's not just kids who are under attack. And too often it's framed as, excuse my language, fucking, you know, parents' rights BS.
So what's really interesting is the New York Times has not been a friend to the trans community in the slightest, but they did an interview with one of the people responsible for the anti-trans campaign. It's with the American Principles Project. And he was rather explicit. We want to make sure that there are no trans people in the United States. Our goal is to end access to transition-related care for everyone. In Britain, you have leading anti-trans campaigners saying that any number of trans people is a major problem to society. You have Michael Knowles with the Daily Wire talking about how we must eradicate transgenderism from public life. And he'll claim, well, that doesn't mean eradicating trans people. Well, you can't talk about eradicating transgenderism any more than you could talk about eradicating Judaism from public life without recognizing exactly what it really is. These laws are just some of the first step, and you can see starting creep into it. The bathroom bans. How do you function when you can't use a public bathroom anywhere in the state? How do you function if you can no longer get health care unless you go to a doctor's office that doesn't take Medicare or Medicaid or use any state funds, and there's no telehealth visit, and there's no more working with a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant? It has to be with a doctor in their office who doesn't get any state or federal funding. And that's what a lot of these laws do. And then there's other laws that make it really super hard for healthcare for trans people, including routine care like hormones. A lot of trans people, just like women who had a hysterectomy or have hit menopause early, take hormones to maintain bone health and maintain health in general. Well, these laws being put in place make it impossible for trans people to get their hormones covered, whereas women with the same hormone deficiencies or men who have the same hormone deficiencies can get them, trans people can't. You know, and this is clearly discriminatory and it's going to go to court. But if you've been paying attention to the Supreme Court, exactly how much faith do you have in Clarence Thomas and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch? At this point, the trans community, we have bans on healthcare for trans people in 16 or 17 states. It's probably going to finish up with somewhere between 20 to 25 by the time the year is over. We're going to see bathroom bans. We're going to see it become very, very difficult to get healthcare for trans adults. We're seeing laws being passed that derecognize trans identities, which means you can no longer get a valid driver's license or a change of birth certificate or use a bathroom technically because the state will not recognize your gender identity. And it sets up all kinds of weird problems of what happens with a trans person using a bathroom in Montana, which Montana doesn't recognize gender identity, but you've got a California driver's license. What about a full faith and credit clause? What about a passport from the federal government? This is leading to some really, really ugly legal questions. But the ugliest that I've hit a number of times is the law in Florida that lets state courts break custody agreements. Because here's what it sets up. Imagine you've got somebody who lives in California and there's a joint custody agreement or a custody agreement. Mom's supportive, dad isn't. Dad grabs a kid, flies to Florida. The mom goes to Florida and there's a Florida legal system and says, my kid must be returned to me by order of the California courts. Now what you have is the Florida courts being told explicitly by law, no, because this child might receive gender-affirming care of some sort. We will not honor California rulings in family court. We will not return them. We are legally barred from returning them. And if you're a fan, and I'm using that with air quotes, of American history, this starts sounding a little familiar. We're coming up on the Fugitive Slave Acts of 1793, of 1850, and one really, really famous case from 1858. You might have heard of it. It's called Dred Scott, where what states determine who is property of whom and who gets to return whom to where? So who is the kid property of and which state's laws determine where that kid ends up? And what happens when, let's say, mom's family has a lot of money and hires the Pinkertons and it's a, you know, midnight raid into dad's house somewhere in Florida and the kid gets taken back and now you've got competing raids and treating children as property and a Supreme Court that's going to eventually decide one way or another because you can't take the kid and cut him in half. But what happens if the court decides in favor of Florida? Now California is going to be like, yeah, we're done here. And if they decide against DeSantis, then Florida is going to be tempted to tell the court to go stuff it with cranberries. But more than anything, given how the actions of Clarence Thomas and Justice Roberts kind of let them eat cake. Don't you know who I am? I'm above you. I don't answer to you, kind of response to Congress. I don't answer to the public. I answer to no one. We are the court. We are above such petty suspicions. We are above all of you. Our position makes us gods. You will respect us merely based on our position, and you have no right to question anything we do. If this devolves the way I worry it will, California and other blue states are going to be very, very tempted to tell the court, absolutely not. We're not letting red states kidnap our citizens and take them back to be subjected to conversion therapy. Or in the case of women who had an abortion in California, you don't get to haul them back to South Carolina for execution. And that's where we're headed. The problem is that the court has absolutely so discredited itself and has been so tolerant of the appearance of corruption that they don't carry a lot of moral weight anymore. Their approval rating and trust ratings are the lowest they've been in American history since we started polling. We don't know exactly what the American public thought in 1859 after Dred Scott, but it's probably somewhere in the vicinity.
100% illegitimate.
yet contemptuous towards anyone who points out their illegitimacy.
There's legitimacy by law, and then there's legitimacy in the eyes of the public. All the people on the court were put there in ways that were absolutely legitimate under the United States Constitution. However, many of them were put there in place by presidents who did not win the popular vote. They have created the appearance of rampant corruption and undue influence. They have created the appearance that they are out of touch with the American public. They give the appearance that they're no longer interested in justice or consistency with rulings like Hawaii versus Trump and Masterpiece Cake Shop. They say that any government interference in religion, in even the slightest hint of it, is constitutionally impermissible. But, you know, as long as the president tells Muslims they can't come into the country, as long as he said it while he was still campaigning and not while he was actually president, then fine. There's no intellectual consistency. My expectation is that the court will be continue to be seen as more and more out of touch, going more and more against the wishes of the public, more and more against the realities of modern life, that everybody gets to have an unlimited number of high capacity firearms and that the government can't interfere with it in any way, even if you are under a restraining order for domestic abuse. Like I predict they're going to do is that they're going to say, okay, trans people can't own guns because obviously they're mentally incompetent. So they'll only take away guns from trans people and let everybody else have them, which, by the way, just pointing it out, Germany, 30s, all the guns away from Jewish people, but they made it much easier for the rest of the population to own guns. Now, I'm going to caution the idea that Jewish people or Roma or anybody else could have prevented the Holocaust by having access to firearms is stupid, but it's a bad, bad, bad sign when you see the most disfavored people being told you can't have guns, but everybody else can have as many as they want. That's a sign that their trajectory is really bad.
I wanted to get a little bit more into that trajectory because you really dug into that in your article in the New Republic. To me, seems to have been a number of escalations in the war on trans folks over the past couple of years, from bathroom bans to bans on sports and other public activities to bans on medical care. And they become more successful and gone from the deep red states to the national stage. And in the article that I've been mentioning, you make the essential point, I feel, that, quote, the laws go so far as to write the existence of trans people out of law to effectively unperson them as a class, end quote. I was wondering if you could speak to a little bit of what can we learn from this trajectory, especially when we look at historical examples of similar things happening. I realize we're recording this on the date of the attack on the first trans clinic in Germany.
Yeah, Magnus Hirschfeld. Yeah. I can never remember the German name.
I butcher it every time, so I don't
have to look at it to pronounce it. Der Institut der Transsexuellen Scheinkraft, if I remember correctly, but I don't speak German. Where we're at here is that removing trans people as a recognizable class under the law is going to have to be adjudicated by the courts because they are, by legal definition, they are a recognizable class of people. They are people who have a gender identity that's different than their sex and behave, act, dress, or comport themselves in a manner that runs counter to gender stereotypes. You can define trans people legally, but if you say that the laws that say, no, this is not a class of people, that's going to have to be adjudicated in the court. But when you say this doesn't constitute a class of people, that does have a legal effect. This is trying to eliminate trans people from being under heightened or intermediate scrutiny, as the court determined in Harris, Bostock, and Zarda, 2019-2020. It reduces us to rational basis scrutiny, which is basically any excuse that the government can come up with why we're discriminating against trans people is sufficient to do the discrimination. And rational basis scrutiny is almost effectively useless. You have no protections at rational basis. And this might even be less than rational basis, because rational basis suggests that the group of people is still cognizable as a group. Left-handed dentists who like Elton John, that's a group of people that if the government can come up with a rational basis for discriminating against left-handed dentists who like Elton John, that dental instruments aren't designed for left-handers, so we're taking away your dental licenses. My point is that this starts looking a little bit like the Nuremberg laws, that you have citizens who have full rights, and then you have this other group of people who are non-citizen residents who have a much lower level of legal protection. that as long as the government can come up with something that's any excuse to do whatever it's going to do, it's going to do it. There's another piece to this that really, really has me worried, is the Texas Department of Agriculture put in a dress code. And I highlighted it. This is how the next administration, the next GOP administration, is going to purge trans people from federal service. They've already introduced a bill in the House and Senate to ban trans people from the military again. But the fact that they're introducing stuff that would force trans people to either detransition or leave federal service and leave the military, this should really worry you, because the first freaking thing the Nazis did was kick all the Jews out of German federal service and out of the Wehrmacht. They would have to kind of reverse themselves, you know, in the case of Price Waterhouse, but keep in mind, they just reversed Roe versus Wade. Stare Decisis is dead. It is functionally, as a concept, gone. Instead of Price Waterhouse, there would be likely to apply, well, what would the founding fathers think about cross-dressers? I don't know. Why don't you ask about the guy who trained the Continental Army? He was famously gay. And it's not just that. There is this tolerance for violence that the clinics that treat trans people and trans youth are getting bomb threats. And we know who's instigating the bomb threats, because they're doing it on Twitter and have millions of followers. And we have proof that since Elon Musk came to power, that he's been deliberately instructing people to shield libs of TikTok and Matt Walsh, right? Just this past week, we had a queer couple named King and Queen of Prom in Ohio. It got picked up by right-wing media. And next thing you know, the school's, you know, eyeballs deep in death threats and bomb threats. And they just arrested somebody. In Ohio, same thing. We had trans man staying at a campground, asked the owner what the policy on trans people was. He said, you're female, you use the female bathrooms. Uses the female bathrooms, walks out, gets the crap beat out of him by people waiting for him outside. And then the cops show up and arrest the trans man for disturbing the peace. This is all trending in a very, very bad direction. And the rhetoric isn't coming down. No. It just keeps ramping up and up and up, because there's no drawback to it. The politicians doing this ramp up because of gerrymandering, like 92-93% of all House races aren't competitive. You know, they won by more than 10 points. The only elections that matter are the primaries. And we're in a competitive outbidding, where you've got two Republicans fighting for a seat that's gerrymandered to the point where a Democrat could never win. And going into the primary, one Republican is going to say, well, I was against trans youth. And the next one's going to say, well, you know what? I want to ban them from bathrooms. This guy's soft. He didn't talk about banning them from bathrooms. I'm going to ban healthcare for adults. I'm going to ban them from government service by instituting a dress code. Yeah, well, you know what? I'm going to institute the death penalty for grooming. Well, you know what? I'm going to institute the death penalty, but I'm going to bring back death by tree shredder, right? And because each of them, well, my opponent is soft on those people. Well, no, I'm not, because I want to do blank. Yeah, well, I'm going to do something worse. And we're really kind of reaching that point. And there was some polling data that came out just this week that showed that something like 85% of Republicans, one of the things they like most in a candidate is how they fight woke. And woke is really just kind of a code word at this point for trans people, Black Lives Matter, but mostly trans people. We're not seeing a lot of talk about CRT and BLM and Antifa. We don't see a lot of talk about that. It's all trans. The entire eye of Sauron is firmly fixed on trans people. I don't see any indication that Republicans are going to do anything different in the 2024 general election. This is going to be one of their primary focuses. What I'm seeing in terms of the rhetoric is that it used to be a little bit few and far between, but now the framing of trans issues is, like I said, apocalyptic. It's us or them. If we do not do something about those people, they will destroy our society. They will destroy our children. They will destroy our culture. They will destroy our nation. They will destroy humanity. They are infecting our body politic, and we have tolerated these people for far too long, and we must stop tolerating them. There can be no tolerance of something that is the worst evil in human history since Mengele and Auschwitz and everything else. And that's an actual comparison that's been made, is that transgender ideology is the greatest evil in human history since the Nazis, since death camps.
It's so disturbing, Bryn, that existence is an ideology.
We see terms like woke mind virus, transgender cults. Trump used that one. And here's the thing, though, is that trans people's ideology is all over the place, in the sense that For God's sakes, you've got Blair White and Caitlyn Jenner.
Ugh. Ew.
You know, okay, yeah, we're not exactly monolithic. And then you swing all the way over to, you know, the other side of it, of the Black liberationist anarcho-communist wing of the trans community. The only central point to trans ideology is we have a gender identity and it's valid. And we would like to be treated the way we'd like to be treated. That's really about all there is to it, is an acceptance that gender is a thing and it's intensely personal and it should be respected the way we respect any other deeply held identity. I would say that trans people have less choice in their gender identity than people have in their religion, but one of them is protected at a fundamental level and the other one isn't. But I would also suggest that you could make a very strong case that religion is far more dangerous and destructive within a society than gender identity.
Why is the GOP doing monstrosity after monstrosity towards trans and non-binary people? But there's also, why are so many people enabling these folks by affording them the benefit of the doubt that maybe they mean something less than eradication and somehow that's okay?
So you see a lot of enablers at places like The Atlantic, New Yorker, New York Times, that they love the controversy. They love the just asking questions. They love the framing of this as a debate or as a horse race. They love leaving out that on the one side you have honest to God, Sieg Eiling, swastikas tattooed on the face, Nazis showing up with AR-15s to drag queen story hour and protesting in front of clinics. And then you have a tiny minority that's being told, we want to eradicate you. And the New York Times is, well, you know what? Some of the people who are supporting the Nazis make some really good points. It sells papers. It generates clicks because people love a good moral panic, and trans people have turned into a moral panic. The same way Dungeons and Dragons was a moral panic, the same way gays were a moral panic during the AIDS crisis. The Lavender Scare, this goes back to the 50s, the same way that there was moral panics about Black people's in white spaces, that they would rape the white women, Chinese taking good American jobs as part of the yellow peril, right? This is whipping up hate and discontent directed at a minority group to benefit a political faction or to sell newspapers. And the same thing today is that you see a lot of these outlets telling stories about, well, medicine is right and trans people do better when they are supported and happy and have jobs and access to healthcare. And here's a story of this perfectly normal trans family living in the Northern Virginia suburbs, living the middle class life, worrying about their mortgage payments going up, or transgender mania, stealing children, mutilating them. This doctor says that it must stop now. Panic, panic, panic. Do you know where your kids are?
And there's no debunking it, Bryn. Like, I feel like the major...
There is debunking. Except the thing is that the major news outlets don't carry the debunking.
That's what I'm talking. There are places that are debunking it for sure. And I don't want to undercount that at all. When DeSantis goes on about the chopping off of 14-year-olds' penises and goes on with this almost pornographic hatred, you don't see CNN going, hold on, wait a second. Let's talk facts and science. Let's have pediatricians talk about what actually is going on. You don't see that. I feel like more often than not, that just gets played and passed over. And that's just normal. That's just what politicians say now.
So something I get a lot of right-wing messaging on is that trans man who shot up the school in Nashville. It was initially reported that this person had a manifesto, and there was a lot of speculation that they shot up the school because they were anti-Christian or they were trans activists. And what I'm getting is, you transgenders are threatening good Americans and Christians and school children because you're angry and you hate God and you're dangerous and deranged. And the trans community did this. And this is a big myth that's never been corrected properly. Is the supposed manifesto wasn't really a manifesto. It was just a bunch of notes of the person who admired school shooters and making plans for shooting up a school. And the reason they chose that school wasn't because it was Christian or because they were discriminated against because they were trans. It was just because they knew that school because that's where they had gone. So one of the big problems we're facing in terms of media disinformation is this narrative about the Nashville shooter And the fact that the narrative is never being questioned within right-wing circles, that they are pushing deliberately this narrative that this a trans person who is an activist went and shot up a school full of kids because they were mad about the governor passing an anti-trans law, or they were mad at Christians or something, when it turns out neither is true.
I was also seeing that that was packaged as part of this bigger trend where this isn't the first time it's happened and this is happening more often and all of that, which is not true.
To set the record straight, there is one shooter who claimed to be trans, but they think they did it because they wanted to avoid hate crimes charges because there's no indication that they were trans beforehand. There were two other people in like 2020 and one in 2018. But when you look at it on the basis of mass shooters in the United States, defined as four more people shot, not including the gunman, there's been over 3,000 of them since 2017 or 2018, and a grand total of three of them were definitively trans. That's three out of 3,000. That's one out of 1,000. And here's the thing is that there's approximately 7 out of 1,000 people are trans, but only 1 out of 1,000 mass shooters are trans. Statistically, trans people are less likely to be mass shooters, although the sample size is so low, you can't draw a lot of statistical inferences, but you cannot draw the statistical inference that trans people are likely to be mass shooters because the data actually says exactly the opposite. But that doesn't fit with a narrative, and that's the narrative that the right wing is running with and the right wing media is running with and that you find everywhere, but nobody seems capable of doing basic statistical analysis. You know, I'm going to fling some hate and discontent at Democrats. When they show up to the hearings on healthcare for trans youth, they haven't done their research. The one side will spit out facts like 97% of trans youth desist. If you've done your research, you would know that that stat is derived from an 80s vintage psychiatrist who was a conversion therapist who wrote a book called Sissy Boy Syndrome. His determination was that only 3% of effeminate boys ended up being trans. That was actually the conclusion. Understanding where the facts came from or who generated them, or the 80% desistance number came from a psychiatrist who promoted conversion therapy in the 80s and 90s, who also diagnosed a lot of kids as trans who weren't trans, to claim that he had a high success rate. But when they went back and reviewed his records in the 2015, they found out that something like 70% of his patients were subclinical, meaning that 80% of his patients that he claimed were trans that he cured weren't trans to begin with because they didn't meet the modern criteria. People don't understand this and they can't debunk it and they don't know to ask the questions, or they don't know how to debunk the experts, or they don't know the science and they're coming in unarmed. So the Republicans come in with these numbers that sound very officious, that sound like they're backed by medical science. No, they're not. And the reason that all these medical organizations have come to the same conclusion on healthcare for trans people is that they've taken in 30 years of data and studies and taken all of the research in context and weighed it based on that context and the quality of the data, which is low, but getting better. And as the data gets better, it tells a clearer and clearer story, and it's not in favor of the people banning it. At the same time, the people that are attacking trans healthcare keep moving the goalpost. For years, it's like, we want a randomized control study on healthcare for trans youth, or we want a longitudinal study. It ran for 5 years and the results were fantastic. These kids are doing great as young adults, 20-somethings. The group started back in 2012, 2013. That's before the trans craze took over. So we're going to ignore that study. Okay, well, here's a randomized control study that you asked for. You know what? We don't like that. We wanted to see how they're doing in 15, 20, 30 years. If you waited 30 years to see long-term effects on things, we would have gotten ibuprofen over the counter in 2015. That's not how you do longitudinal studies. You don't wait 30 to 50 to 80 years. Okay, well, they're dead now. Or yeah, they're on their deathbed. Let's do a psychological survey to see how transitioning affected them now that they're 80 and dying of pancreatic cancer. That's not how medicine works. That's not how studies work. That's not how determining efficacy works. But because these legislators and the people supporting this aren't doing this based off of science, aren't doing this in good faith. And that's something that media outlets like the New York Times don't seem to recognize. One side is doing this in good faith. One side isn't. And when they portray the people that are trying to ban trans people as concerned citizens and parents with kids that they're worried that their kid is going to emotionally crash if they lose access to treatment, treat those parents as activists and the kids as activists. That's a unfair framing meant to lead people to a particular conclusion, even though in reality, the parent with the kids is just trying to keep their kid alive. And the person trying to ban trans healthcare really is one degree of separation away from the people with swastika tattoos on their faces, because the ones with the tattoos on their faces are the enforcers. They are the Sturmabteilung of the conservative movement. And the people trying to ban trans people are the leadership.
I think that's really clarifying.
They're giving them their indirect marching orders of, we're going to label healthcare for trans people as the most evil, awful thing in American culture today. And wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Wouldn't it be awful if a clinic burned down or there were people out front with AR-15s? And I guess it couldn't be helped if good American citizens were making sure that doctors were afraid to practice medicine because this is so evil. People like Libs of TikTok and Matt Walsh laugh at the concept of stochastic terrorism, but it's real. It's the same kind of stochastic terrorism we saw with abortion clinics.
It's from the same cloth.
It's the same people. It's the fascists.
100%. And it seems as though, as you were talking, instead of fighting this, and to be clear, I am talking politically, people are hoping that the Democratic Party will go all out to stop this. Meanwhile, it seems that the Democrats are hoping that reasonable Republicans will put the brakes on it. And there, I feel, continues to be the belief by all too many people that there is this line that they won't cross, that maybe they'll find a new target or get enough of this and then they'll relent. Or sometimes this is framed as, see, the courts blocked these bans. You're being hyperbolic, Sam. This isn't a genocide, or however that's framed.
You bring up genocide. Something I remind people is that the most famous genocide is the Holocaust. There are two schools of thought within Jewish historian communities, is that nothing will ever be the Holocaust and nothing can ever be compared to the Holocaust and nothing should ever be compared to it, and that it is a unique one-off in human history. There is a competing school of thought among Jewish philosophers who study the Holocaust. In particular, I would cite Hannah Arendt and Milton Mayer. I would also call out the conclusions of Theodore Adorno, which is that the Holocaust is not a one-off, that there's the banality of evil, and that virtually any society is capable of genocide, according to Adorno and Hannah Arendt in their analyses. The U.S. is no different. Any other country is no different. That's what they recognize, is that the potential for genocide lies in any society. Looking at the United States where we are today, where we have arrived is that you have one side calling for the eradication of transgenderism from public life. That means no visible trans people. How do you do that? Well, you make sure that they can't go outside, can't be around children, they can't hold jobs, they can't use bathrooms, they can't be out in public, they can't get an education, you can't talk about them, you can't acknowledge them, they can't get identification, they can't be recognized as a group or recognized as full citizens. And the result is that they either disappear by detransitioning, or they never transition, or the ones who can't do either flee. And if you look at the kinds of things that are being done, pushing them out of federal service, pushing them out of athletics, pushing them out of the military, pushing them out of medicine, banning them from public spaces, banning them from arts and theater, right? You can't perform, or giving them government IDs that mark them as part of the disfavored group. These all have very, 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 very clear, direct parallels to the time period between 33 and 38. And that the ultimate goal to make people disappear, Germany's goal was to get them to leave. And we're seeing with trans people, they're either saying, I'm never going to come out and transition, or I'm leaving. I'm getting an unending stream of messages that it was one of two things of, I'm leaving, or I'm taking my kid and leaving. We're going to a blue state. We're emigrating. We're getting out. Or I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have the money to flee. What people forget is that approximately two-thirds of Germany's Jews fled between 33 and the outbreak of World War II. They went from 538-ish thousand people to 170,000-ish, something that people forget even after Kristallnacht in 38. They arrested 30,000 Jewish men, approximately. Most of them were released within weeks or months. the condition of their release was signing a piece of paper that says, we will leave Germany and never come back. The goal is to get people to leave, flee, disappear. And that's what we're seeing now. The thing that scares me is that trans people have been framed as such an existential threat, as such an intolerable threat, that there should be no tolerance as the most evil thing in America today. And the question I would ask is, what happens to the people who can't or won't disappear or flee? There will be some. That will be the one third or whatever that can't. And the trans community doesn't have a lot of money. We are typically fairly impoverished. My income dropped by 35% after I came out, after I lost my main job and my secondary job. The question I ask is, so what are Republicans going to do to that one third that can't or won't leave or disappear? Because the Germans asked that same question around 40, 41, and they had a conference. They even have a name for it, the Wannsee Conference in January of 42. What are we to do with these people? What is the answer to the Jewish question? And the answer was the final solution. People are recognizing that the situation is dangerous and unstable, and it is time to leave. At some point after 4, 5, 6 years of laws getting nastier and nastier and nastier and making life less and less tenable, you're going to be left with some poor population that can't or won't flee, that have all clustered up for mutual protection. And the state of Texas and the state of Florida is going to ask, they're still here. What do we do with those who remain? They have made it clear that any trans people are unacceptable, yet here is this unacceptable population that we don't dare tolerate. We will not tolerate that. We have built our entire political identity around not tolerating the existence of, and they're still here. What are we to do with them?
I think that the clarity of what the stakes are and where this is headed that you bring forward, I think is extremely, extremely helpful and critical right now for people to not just sit with and not just feel and not just be angry and saddened and scared, but actually act upon it because people's lives are right now in danger. I've been thinking a lot about the hypocrisy of the same people that decry, save the children, protect the women, to justify book bans, purging the curriculum, preventing trans women from using the goddamn women's bathroom, are the same people forcing 10-year-olds to birth rapist babies, criminalizing parents who take their child out of state to get an abortion, the same people advocating for the seizing of children from their parents that the parent helps them get life-sending.
Let's not forget child brides.
Oh, yeah. The same people who are saying yes to child brides and yes to children working. Get those children in the mines ASAP. And the same people making decisions for parents on the healthcare of the children. And I can't help but think there is like a through line here, something that goes beyond or beneath the hypocrisy. And I was hoping that you could help me find what that is. Because it's got to be more than hypocrisy, right?
It's religion. It's a particularly fundamentalist, particularly American strand of religion that was always susceptible to fascism. If you look at Sinclair Lewis, and you can see his book, It Can't Happen Here, somewhere on the shelf behind me, he pointed out that when fascism came to the U.S., it was going to be of a particularly religious Southern variety. His book created the presidential character of Buzz Windrip, who was supposed to be a fascist, and he was modeled after Huey Long, Southern kind of populist, right-wing, very racist. There's the nastiest, least democratic strain of American politics has always emanated out of the U.S. South. And over time, they went from being Democrats to Republicans as the great shift happened. Underneath it all is this certainty that what they are doing is God's will, and that this is based off of a fundamental idea of social dominance orientation, that white people are on top, then Christians. You got white Christians, and you got other Christians, and then you got everybody else underneath it. And that the right order of things is that those people, and those people now they have decided are trans, those are the people that have gone way above their station, and they need to be put back way down. They need to be driven underground. They need to be driven out. They are unacceptable. That this is the natural order of things, and that God wills this. This is what God wants. This is good for America. This is good for our women. This is good for our children. They don't see it as hypocritical because they can apply the Bible, child brides, or forcing children to die in childbirth because they have a religious backing to it. American Christianity has become a primarily right-wing tool. 90% of U.S. congregations are hostile to LGBT people, whereas approximately 70% of Americans support same-sex marriage. If you asked your average American, you're going to a bathroom, how terrified are you that you will run into a transgender person? Like, is this something that keeps you up at night and paralyzes you? And it's not. And to a large extent, this is driven by fear and paranoia by 20% of the population, 25%. But it's also driven by social dominance orientation and a religious view that some of them aren't really afraid of trans people. Their feelings are purely, these people are evil and disgusting, and they need to be destroyed because they are fundamentally wrong. They're not scared of us. They just flat out hate us.
I think that it's really helpful to be regrounded in the implications of this theocratic movement and what ties what seems to be antagonistic viewpoints together. I want to thank you so much, Bryn, for taking the time and sharing your perspective, your expertise, and your insight with us. We're going to link to your latest book, your Twitter, all of that. If you have anything else you wanted to say or plug, I just wanted to give you the space to do so.
Sorry, I'm such a cheery ray of sunshine.
I think that where we find hope is partially in looking at reality as it is. And we are incapable of standing up to something if we don't know what it is that we're standing up to.
The way I'd frame it for people, trans people, are like, well, you got to give them hope. It's like, I'm an analyst and a military historian. My perspective is that good decisions are only made by accident in the absence of information. And I'm providing information so that people can make better decisions.
I think that's a great way to close. Thanks so much, Bryn.
Thank you.
This past week, the Washington Post published poll data from last December declaring in bold type that popular anti-trans views prove that, quote, most Americans support anti-trans policies favored by GOP, end quote. The problems with this article are profound and layered, including that general beliefs don't automatically convert to support of genocidal policies, that more recent polling suggests a backlash against the policies, and more. But most fundamentally, it must be said that people's basic rights are not and should not be determined or guaranteed by their popularity. The history of the rights of LGBTQ people, of immigrants, of people with disabilities, all show the perils of leaving the determination of rights up to the whim of the majority. Here in this country, despite the widespread revisionist history, Rosa Parks and the Freedom Riders and the Black Panther Party and even MLK all polled very poorly in their time, as have the general idea of and specific policies geared toward respecting and guaranteeing basic rights for Black people for the majority of the history of this country. On the other hand, the implication that these anti-trans GOP policies would be illegitimate if only they didn't have majority support is deeply flawed, as history is full of examples of deeply unpopular but powerful and entrenched minorities wielding power over oppressed and exploited majorities. We must recognize that this is a fight over essential and, yes, inalienable human rights, and that it is a power struggle, not a popularity contest. And it is time to get in the streets, to get loud, to refuse fascism. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. We want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests. Lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman. Drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@RefuseFascism.org. Connect with us over at Mastodon. See the link in the show notes. Leave us a voicemail. We'd love to hear from you. See the show notes for that message button. And if you want to support the show, thank you. You're awesome. It's super simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Become a patron to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. For as little as $2 a month, you can help make a difference in producing and promoting this independent weekly podcast. Give today at patreon.com/refusefascism or make a one-time contribution by visiting refusefascism.org and hitting the donate button. Thanks for your support. And thanks to Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Jingleman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode. So be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.